Welcome back. So now we begin the process of taking our leave. We do so with deep gratitude to Your Holiness and to all who have brought us together for an encounter that we will long remember. Thank you so very much. We've had a rich and rewarding dialogue. It has seemed to me that, in a way, we were having two simultaneous conversations for much of our time. One about the human brain, delving very deeply all the way to its primitive core, as we heard. The other about the human mind and its many mysteries. As we did that, we would pull ourselves back from time to time and look from a wider angle, opening a larger context to take account of social and cultural factors, pulling back from the scholarship for a moment to ask how we might apply the fruits of all this knowledge to relieve suffering in the world. That desire for usable knowledge, as Your Holiness has said, has always been the animating spirit behind these conversations, the dedicating of our learning to the benefit of all. Those two conversations about the brain and about the mind intersected from time to time, informed and enfolded one another, we might say, in a kind of stylized dance, almost. One question that remains for us is how they integrate. That's the question that originated these dialogues 27 years ago, Varela's question, we might call it, and it does persist. Can we map our map of the mind onto our map of the brain? And if we can do that eventually as we intend, what is it exactly that we will have done? What use will it be? That's a fascinating and important question with which we It's clear that the lines of influence have been running in both directions, that the presentations we heard this week from the Buddhist scholars reflect these years of mutual exploration. I think we can see and feel the evidence of that, and that the neuroscientific endeavor has been shaped and is being shaped in the crucible now of 2,000 years of Buddhist science, as Your Holiness said. Both conversations and the challenges of bringing them together are reminding us of the enormous complexity of the task that we have taken up. The complexity of the human brain, surely its structure, its regions, its circuitry, its chemistry, its plasticity, all these things we've learned about. And the complexity of the human mind, its inappropriate mentation, attachments, excessive devotions, projections, afflictions, and its delusions, all 84,000 of them, and none more afflictive than our clinging to the self.
So 84,000, as Matula actually pointed out, that it's better to leave it in this broad outline, because if you were to specifically count all of them, then there's not possible. However, having said this, His Holiness is reminding us that in the Buddhist sources, when it comes to various factors that constitute our mental experience, referred to as mental factors, there's a list of 51, and some of the more expanded list includes up to 100 and something. Mm. And these mental factors are not only individually identified, but they're also defined and their functions identified and so on.
Mm.
So they're distinctly identified, defined, and then their functions identified.
Mm. 다른 거 개심부지 되셔고 충된 직 봐도 테마타가 테마타 경기 서버에다 딘디기 경기 교화 컨트롤 스토리에 충된 게 교화 컨트롤 스토리에 딘디 심부지 개심부지
And one of the important facts that is considered in this Buddhist or you know ancient Indian psychology is how concomitant factors. So when you have a particular mental event, how does the concomitant factors influence its expression in a particular given situation, as well as how does the immediately preceding moment, the antecedent, you know, impact its expression. So these are important considerations that are found in the
Buddhist sources.
And the reason for this is that when you are to apply any kind of intervention or antidote, unless you have a better understanding of not just the mechanism and the process itself, but are the other influencing factors that are part of that experience, as well as what are the antecedent fact forces that are in shaping it. Without that, you know, you might choose a particular antidote which seemed like the counter point of it, but it may not actually work.
Actually, yes, I think Buddhism, of course, very much sort of, based on compassion, so non-violence. But you see, when we explain how to combat the destructive emotion, that usually sometimes we describe as the enemy. So now here, so in order to take effective offensive, we must know the enemy's condition fully. Under sort of low estimatory.
If you underestimate it. So then if you underestimate the strength of your opponent, then the counter.
So similar, you see, we must know the negative emotion, how it developed. Right. It is immediate causes, or what is immediate causes, and other conditions. And knowing that, then the offensive, accordingly, then take.
The antidote, Lam.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So, okay. Your Holiness, then, speaking of knowing the enemy, we were very moved this morning when you spoke of the monk who had been in the Chinese gulag and been tormented and was able to maintain his compassion for his tormentor. That was a very powerful story for us. It went deep. We've been hearing this week in our conversations that Western societies stigmatize and marginalize people with addictions, the people with the conditions we've been discussing. They see them as responsible for their situation, despicable even, sometimes hate them, marginalize them, send them to prisons. We talked about how many are in prisons. How can we soften our hard hearts in the face of that enemy?
So other than really reminding people of the fundamental fact, humanity of that person,
right.
You know, just as oneself, that person too wishes to be happy. And furthermore, if you look at the spiritual teachings, so this which is common to all the great teachings of the world's spiritual traditions, there is a special emphasis placed on not losing your compassion for the marginalized, for
right.
the weak. So, for example, in the Tibetan mind training text. So in the Tibetan mind training text, known as the 8 verses on mind training, there's a particular line which emphasizes from the point of view of a spiritual practitioner whose aim is to cultivate compassion for all beings, then having interaction with these kind of individuals is even should be seen as a precious opportunity. So there's a line which says that, when I encounter people who are in this kind of difficult situations, who seem to be indulging in destructive behavior and so on, may I, you know, appreciate the opportunity almost like a kind of a treasure, and, you know, generate compassion. Of course, it's difficult to implement in actual practice.
Right. Yes.
You need a lot of sort of that.
So you need to really cultivate that way of thinking, make it a habit by reflection, through reflection.
Right. Thank you. And I think the caregivers, Sarah, Roshi, Joan, who work with these people do feel that way, that they are the beneficiaries of the opportunity. But the problem is creating that in the wider society. That is our struggle. Thank you. Thank you. That is helpful. So we've talked about complexity that could make a person's head hurt, as our wonderful presenter Nora said about her head, a person whose head is filled with a very lively mind. And we can sometimes feel that complexity is our problem, but there's no escaping it, and as I think we've heard, it is inordinately beautiful as well, this human mind, even as it eludes our full comprehension. The American jurist, a man named Oliver Wendell Holmes, is said to have said that he had no patience with what he called the simplicity on the near side of complexity.
What's that?
Simplifications of complex phenomena. He wasn't interested in those.
So if it is a complex phenomena, we have to acknowledge and therefore, the emphasis on education.
Right, absolutely.
We need expert.
Right, right.
But we never find answer, simplify that. We must know the reality.
But he said we do seek simplicity on the far side of complexity, and that's the ultimate prize. Going through all of the expertise, all of the complexity, and coming through with simplicity. And I think Your Holiness has done that for us this week. So I want to ask Your Holiness if I have it right. So I think you have been saying, when you've spoken of the deeper level, this place where we can shed our ignorance of the fundamental reality, that we are all human beings together, that we are the same in that respect, despite our vast diversity, that we all want to be happy, that all beings possess what in your tradition you call Buddha nature, and what Christians recognize as the spark of God, and that all of us, religious or not, can know as love. It's as simple as that, the path to inner peace. It's simple, but it's not easy. And I think that may be where our two conversations come together, the mind and the brain, in that place of peace. Okay, keep going. We've covered a great deal of material, and much of it has been highly sophisticated, and it's going to take us some time, I think, for it to settle. We'll be living, I think, for a time with the question of what claims this experience will be making on us, all of us, the participants, the witnesses in the room, the monks and the other special guests who have given us the gift of their attention and who've helped hold this space for us and with us, who've helped make it a sacred space. We are all going to go through a settling process. one akin to one described by John Gardner. Has His Holiness met John Gardner, a writer in the United States, who writes on self-renewal? He describes self-renewal as an endless and unpredictable dialogue between our potentialities and the claims of life, not only the claims they encounter, but the claims we invent.
그래서
we will have a moment to hear from our participants what they will be taking away in a moment. I just want to say one more thing and to ask Your Holiness about it. Throughout the week, I have been struck with the important role that laughter has played in our proceedings, how often you have laughed. We know now, we have learned now, that it is releasing surges of dopamine in our brains.
I don't know what you said.
Dopamine release chiggers.
But laughter.
How did you grow?
Yeah, but it's more pleasant when you laugh.
If everybody is very serious.
Right.
And the best joke is to shake the chocolate.
And then, you know, as if we are doing it because we are, you know, expected to do it, like a kind of a burden.
So, yes.
It is just to do it.
And then you feel the time goes very slow.
Could meet me too, as I mentioned before. You see, we should keep in our mind, we are talking another human being. He want, she want, the happy. I want to. Same. And so no point pretend I'm happy again. No use. Once you see pretension, right? Pretension comes, then become more difficult. Isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Completely open.
Yeah.
Then, also our work also then become really useful. We sincerely, seriously talking. So very good. Not artificial way. Artificial way never produce concrete result. Then finally, gun is better. Isn't it? You see?
No,
I think, you see, kids does how to say, target, you know, you should be gun girl.
So the problem with, you know, bringing pretense as a sort of a basis to engage in conversation, since nothing can be resolved, then of course people do end up sometimes using
force.
Guns.
Using force, like that. So that's exactly happened on this planet. When they, you see, dealing with problem, not seriously, not sincerely, but always you keep one's own interest and then pretend it as a peace-loving nation. My first visit, Soviet Union, 1979. This is some media in Moscow. You see, someone, you see, tried to put in my mouth the word of loving, peace-loving nation. I didn't repeat that. Then he got some irritation.
He was irritated.
Like that, okay.
Well, you've given us this laughter. We Westerners tend to take life too seriously, I think, sometimes.
Americans are totally. I think Americans better, I think.
Americans are better.
Well, easier. Some of the Europeans, I think Italian better. I think German and the Swiss also, I think, a little bit.
Yeah.
and also Japanese.
We're going to get ourselves in trouble, Your Holiness.
We're going
to have some enemies.
Yes.
We better be careful.
Yes, better to talk humanity.
Your Holiness, I had written down some things and I've put them away. I'm having too much fun laughing with you. But just to say, as I said, I'm an educator. I am deeply inspired by your teachings on education, the need for education, for secular education. We will go back home. We will work very hard.
Thank you. Thank you.
To bring this to fruition.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're very inspired by you. And so I would like to invite my colleagues, any who feel moved to do so, to say something about what any of them think they will take away. Nora.
Take the microphone, please.
I'm taking away many, many things, so it's very hard to pick up one. And I was going to pick another one, but again, I was completely taken aback about your last statement, that you are able, you taught us how you can say things that are of great depth in a, as you say, very simple way, but also to challenge us in ways that do not create a defense by laughing with us.
Yes.
And that is crucial, because if we are not able to communicate differences in thinking without becoming defensive, there's no way of going forward. So I learned that I learned many things, but that is, I think, a wonderful lesson.
Your Holiness, when this meeting was planned and we had our meeting in Boston to consider the topics and to all the presenters were there reviewing their material, it was not clear to me at that time that the intersection between the topics that we were considering and the broader agenda on secular ethics would be so apparent. And one of the, for me, one of the extremely valuable lessons of this meeting has been the number of times that Your Holiness has mentioned education. And we've cycled back to that. I think that the effort to incorporate into education strategies that can prevent the kind of problems that we're all dealing with is absolutely crucial. And we as a species have a moral imperative to do everything we can to put into place the mechanisms in our education system to achieve those outcomes. And I think that you have given us additional inspiration for the broader efforts of Mind and Life in this area. I think that it's just been enormously helpful. And going forward, I think that this meeting will play an important role in that larger effort. So with that, we're all very deeply grateful.
It's been a thrill to be here in so many ways, but of all the things that I think I'll take away, the biggest is the amazing diversity of perspectives we have here as a group. There's so many different angles, so many different viewpoints, and they actually work together. They actually are complementary with each other. And when you put them together, you get a bigger picture and a better picture. That's it's a very good lesson. So, thank you.
Very right.
I think following on that, I've been appreciating the need for the accuracy and the precision and the fine-tuned attention and methodology that goes into this kind of science, and how that can integrate so beautifully with also the heart that and the compassion that are at the center of what we're studying, and that science doesn't have to be hard and cold. It can be very precise and also very compassionate.
I would like to follow on that. And I also, there's so many, many, many things that I will take with me home from this, these 5 days and this meeting. One of the things that I have been really sort of is in the front of my head all the time is, and that I will take with me home, is the sort of the universal nature of craving, and how can I also in my work sort of have that perspective within the field of addiction and problematic substance use, so that it sort of bears towards all human beings and not just certain human beings. Thank you.
Yeah, okay. I'm wondering so much about the relation between understanding and practice, two themes that have come up this week. So many of us have been concerned with understanding the mind. And I think if a theme has emerged to kind of connect us over the week, to me that theme may have been that all of us have conceived of the mind as containing a number of parts and interested in the relation among those parts. Your Holiness has stressed a number of times the need for formative education that might allow a person to escape from the grasping mind and into compassion and better aspiration. Wendy yesterday described escape from self into a nothingness and a sense of love beyond that, a similar theme. A number of us are concerned with the grasping mind and trying to understand the mechanisms of grasping. And Sarah talked today about controlling grasping, bringing it under the ego self to better control. Nora described what goes wrong in addicts in the grasping mind. Some of us have looked through neuroscience as kind of a lens to the mind, but all of us have been interested in parts of the mind. All of this has been understanding, which we value and pursue, and I know Your Holiness values and everyone here values. Yet the theme from the meeting, the theme of the foundation and the stress, the emphasis of Your Holiness so often is on practice and better education and better ways to go forth in practice. So I'm sure all of us wonder whether there's a way to more usefully connect. And as we pursue understanding, are there forms of understanding or avenues that might be more useful in the view of Your Holiness or in the view of the foundation? Perhaps the answer, perhaps there isn't one, and we should all pursue independently and hope for surprises that help. But if there were, I'm sure we would all love to be guided as we go forth.
You know, when we speak, very often when you speak with journalists or politicians about the benefits of mind training, of values, and one of the arguments that they often say, it is all fine, you know, for upper middle class people in the West, you know, who can afford emotionally and time-wise to spend time with training their mind. say, no, why are you talking about those stuff, you know, for very poor people in difficult countries and difficult environment in difficult areas? And they dismiss it because of that. So to hear that, you know, that homeless people who live in cars not only would come to that regularly, but 6 months later, half of them, whether they are still in their car maybe or in homeless, would continue that meditation. That's, you know, that's absolutely amazing. And that's the perfect answer to those who say it's only for middle class people who have nothing to do, you know, on Saturday afternoon or something like that. So likewise, you know, the richest program of preschoolers is specifically done in an area where they are from very difficult social environment. You know, sometimes single parents or they live on food tickets, and still it has a remarkable effect. And likewise, I wanted to give the example of a school in England called Kidlington. It was started in 1993 in a very poor suburb of Oxford. And they also started in a very, against a very difficult environment. No, they didn't go to the rich areas. And they entirely based on values. So every month there is one value that on every other teaching is based, even geography. So they take every month, for instance, respect, benevolence, responsibility, cooperation, trust, tolerance, openness, patience, peace, courage, honesty, humility, gratitude. So the whole would be written over the walls of the school, etc., etc. So what they found is not only that they got average academic result, 30% higher than all the schools around, but also especially the atmosphere there is exceptional. You know, people from all over the world came to see, and in 2003 in Australia, 315 schools decided to adopt that model and 100,000 students. So those are things which is not just like, you know, daydreaming, you know, it's nice to teach values, you know, but you can't do that with very poor kids, you know, tough environment and all that. It's just the opposite. And those examples show that we should not think that it's a luxury for, you know, for wealthy or easy middle-class Western people and then forget about going to difficult areas. So that's all the more encouraging, I think. And also the how much people value that. Just the last example, you know, Tanya Singer is doing a one-year study on empathy, compassion, loving kindness, and so, with 400 people, volunteers who come to the lab. Normally, over such a long period, you get a lot of dropout. People start, and then they have other things they drop. I don't know what's the average, but you could expect 20, 30% maybe, something like that. After already 4 months on the study, she had only 3% of dropouts. That means the people are extremely committed to do it. That means they sense the benefit from it. And those are randomly selected people from a group of volunteers. So I think this is very encouraging that we can really reach where need is. And that's, I think, it makes all the more sort of confidence, enthusiasm, and determination from our side that we can do something useful.
I would like to be too
sure.
I can feel very overwhelmed with the problems in the world and their intractable quality. But I'm also aware of the great thirst of people, homeless people, children, my own students. And I feel very inspired to continue to seek synergistic practices, not just one, but just as we created something from our diversity that couldn't have happened with any one of us, I think about bringing to bear what combination of things, compassion, meditation, awareness, study, and all the different doorways that you can take it to, teaching, drug addiction, parenting, just everywhere you are. So I feel very moved by the example of Your Holiness and by the example of this group about how the interaction of things is so fruitful. So I feel, I don't know if hopeful is the right word, but inspired to do whatever work is possible to do.
In this meeting, like the meeting on the environment, we were 2 years ago addressing very practical issues in the world, and this meeting as well. This is suffering. This is what we've talked about in these days together, the truth of suffering. I think about the men in prison that I worked with years ago, and their faces, and also moments within the experience of one or another where there was awareness, the presence of awareness. And for me, just dwelling in my own experience as, excuse me, an engaged Buddhist, not just one who's in, you know, quiescent state, but as an engaged Buddhist, the application of what we have learned in this meeting and in several previous meetings in terms of a kind of imperative that I feel is in our face right now. It's time in a certain way for us to look even more deeply in vis-a-vis the brain science and really drill down in, you know, mapping, you know, what are the mechanisms that give rise to suffering. By the same token, it's absolutely time that we apply what we've been learning over these years in a practical, powerful way, in a kind of revolution of values and of also ethos, a revolution of a state of heart and mind. And, you know, I appreciate so much the philosophical perspectives, the religious perspectives, the social perspectives, the scientific perspectives. And I think you pointed to something really important, Wendy. And that is that our community here represents a vision of collaboration and of cooperation that we hope to engender as a model of process in the future. This is not about taking a stand from one perspective, but it is really about a kind of collective vision that arises through interactions that are fundamentally wise, respectful, and that are based in deep compassion. So I, you know, Arthur, I feel we're at a kind of break point. You know, it's a sort of place where the tide is shifting and where we need to step into that tide to help move it in the direction that Your Holiness has been pointing to for years. It's applying what we have learned over the past 27 meetings and quarter of a century to ending suffering.
Maybe...
So Roshi, you have several times this week commented on the moment we are in, and I did have something I wanted to say about that if there was time. If you ask any parents in the West, or probably anywhere, what they want for their child, they will say sincerely and passionately that they want their child to be happy and they want him to be a good person. But happy in our Western culture, and as well, I'm afraid, often good, translate now to material success. Educational systems are created to serve societies in the industrial era. We had an educational system that stamped out dutiful bureaucrats. And now we have a hungry economic system that needs greedy consumers. Go shopping, we Americans were told after the 9/11 attacks. So that's happiness. These parents want their child to get into the best school, to do very well there, to be admitted to the best university. I know that. I used to run one. To get the very best first job after graduation, mm-hmm. to succeed at that, to move up the ladder of prestige. That's happiness. Someone used the word narcissism yesterday, and it reminded me of a passage of a book I read in the late 1970s. It was called The Culture of Narcissism by a man named Christopher Lash. He wrote, "When a man adopts a vertical vision of career, worry is his constant companion." Today we would say a man or a woman, a boy or a girl, and we might now add, when a society adopts a hierarchical vision of the meaning of life, greed and fear will be its bitter toxins. The gap between the rich and poor has been widening rapidly, alarmingly, in the U.S. and throughout the West. The hierarchical vision has been consuming us, and the toxin has infected our educational systems. Research that has been done for years at the University of California in Los Angeles, asking young Americans as they prepare to leave for college, what is it that they hope to gain there? For decades, the majority said they wanted to develop a philosophy of life, to understand life's meaning, to find a sense of purpose. More recently, the primary goal young people state for college is to find a good job, earn a good salary, succeed in the world. Our definition of success has been ever more distorted. Young people know that. They feel it, but they feel utterly trapped by it. At my college, students used to say, "I'm taking economics for my father. For my mother, I'm taking art history." So what is this all about? Where does it come from? Your Holiness mentioned fear as the emotional mechanism driving many of our delusions, and I believe you are right. The shift in the culture, the way it is speeding up, heating up, the feeling that so many have that they are being driven by forces beyond their control. We all know it. We all feel it. We could call it addiction, I think, from what we've heard this week. There's a growing fear, I think, that all the reliable structures are starting to break down. Economies, national and global, governance structures around the world, certainly back home where I come from. The very possibility of any kind of global governance, Your Holiness mentioned the impasse in Copenhagen. The environment and all the life support systems on which human life depends, and beneath all of that are basic value systems. All of these support systems around us seem to be cracking apart, and that creates a terrifying feeling that we're in free fall. So people are looking for a haven in a heartless world. That's the title of another book. We delude ourselves into thinking that if we can separate ourselves from others, if we can create isolated enclaves, then maybe we can be safe. And the tragedy is, as Your Holiness teaches, that exactly the opposite is true. We need to reach out to one another if we are to be safe. Well, that sounds like a depressing picture as we talk about our educational vision. But I do see an opening for hope, as Roshi has suggested, and I want to ask Your Holiness if you see it as I do. Because when powerful structures that have held a dominant order in place begin to shift, cracks can sometimes open up and shafts of light can shine through. And I see this work that we are doing here as a light that can shine through the cracks and illuminate a better, a more human way forward for us all. And that's the story I tell myself as we leave here, so that I leave filled with hope.
Thank you, Diana. Thank you, Your Holiness. It falls to me to close this gathering. I can't believe it, right? As I look around the room and see so many familiar faces from so many parts of the world, and our wonderful monk scholars who've been asking these questions, it's just 2 years from now we'll find a time to reconvene on another topic. But I want to begin with a few thank yous. Of course, I want to begin by first of all thanking you for your 26 years, 27 meetings. That's a lot of patience. I want to also thank Tenzin Takla and Chimi. Mm-hmm. I don't know where they are, but wherever you are, thank you very much. Without them, this would not take place. Your staff. I want to thank the presenters. You know who you are. We all know who you are, so we needn't... Oh, there you guys are. There's Chimi. Is Tenzin Takla back there, too?
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay, come on out and step forward, because most people don't know you. I know. Yeah. Tenzin Takla and Chimi. You can't imagine the hundreds of emails that have gone back and forth. Yeah. The presenters that have been with us, Diana Chapman Walsh and Roshi Joan and you two, Richie, who have been our moderators, they've done an extraordinary job, don't you think? Just presenting the fullest array of insights and possibilities, keeping us on course. I want to also thank my board and staff. Maybe it would be good for my board to stand that, well, we've got Roshi Joan and you, Richie, and Diana Chapman Walsh, Carolyn Jacobs, Barry Hershey, Rip, and Monica. Also, wouldn't you mind standing just to see who you are? Have I got everybody? Yes. Jimpa.
Jimpa, our chair.
Our chair. Me too. Yeah. And I want to recognize my dear, dear staff members who are here, Heather, Jackie, and Wendy. Heather, stand up. Jackie. Wendy. Thank you. As you know, nothing happens without the capable hands of such people as this. You know, there are also many sponsors in the audience, people who have given out of their largesse and have made this possible. But I want to just thank the Hershey Family Foundation specifically. And there are three members, I think, of this family here. So thank each and every one of you for the past and the present, and I'm confident also the future. So thank you very much. My thoughts, you know, go back to last night when we were at TIPA and seeing the young performers, you know, presenting the traditional dress and songs and dance music with such great beauty. And there's a wonderful novel by Dostoevsky called The Idiot. But the idiot is the one who can speak the truth. He is the simple, honest soul. At the very end, he speaks the line which is much beloved, that beauty shall save the world. And one thinks of all the sufferings of Tibet and of your holiness and your community, and that the arts can still sing with such vibrancy is something where you do feel that these arts, the beauty of the arts, can save the world. You know, my thoughts always go back to ancient stories and the like. And there are stories that really have to do with desire. Not only desire that becomes craving and attachment and then addiction, but one of the other things we spoke about was the eros, the desire that becomes eros in its nascent and most sublime form of aspiration, that the warmth is a warmth of heart that becomes luminous and can light our path, and that the love that we experience can become the deepest source of our values, not values which are learned by rote, which constrain us like rules, but values which become a way of being in the world. You know, Marguerite Poiret, I know this is strange for a physicist to be studying Marguerite Poiret, but you've just got to go read her and you'll see why. Marguerite Poiret speaks about what she calls the great church, the large church, right? and that the small church in which she had been living and studying and learning was a church of, you could say, restraint and virtues. And for many, many years, she had been a dutiful student in that church, a practitioner in that church of restraint and virtue. But that now, she said, I take leave of those virtues in order to go into the church of love, from which all those virtues truly arise. You could say the church of compassion. And as I look around this room also, I feel like, you know, we are here not because we have to be, not because we're being dutiful, but because of this compassion that we have for the world, that each one of us brings into our work, each one of us brings into our life. So maybe this is a little chapel in that great church. And its priest is perhaps Your Holiness, but...
You've got him laughing again.
But perhaps each one...
As long as I'm saying, in that case, he will need a different kind of costume. Something that is quite restraining, you know?
Yes. Big hat.
I think you're doing just fine, costumed however you may be. You know, the other comment which a number of you have made is that there are many different types of voices at the table. You know, the understandings provided of the antidotes, for example, and the genesis of desire and so forth by Mathieu, and Nora's brilliant depiction of the brain and the nervous system, the dopamine system, and Sarah's depiction of the suffering and remediation of that through mindfulness practices and so on, all the way around the room. And yet I think there's something more that's required than simply the presence of these individuals. And that is that as you speak, that I see the world through your eyes. I'm no neuroscientist, but you speak with such clarity and intensity that I can feel that. And same sort of thing with you as you're working with those who are deeply addicted, and in your ways of teaching mindfulness and cognitive-based therapies and so forth, and all the way around the room, this extraordinary capacity for empathetic understanding that we can animate. And I think this is so human. You talk about the rat's brain and the adult human being brain, but I think part of this capacity is the perspective taking of others, that I can truly live into each and every one of these great souls. And so it's not just that we add, as it were, the sum of our parts, but we actually live through each other in ways which are truly uniting. By now you know I like old stories, old myths and legends. And one of them is about Isis and Osiris. This is an Egyptian myth. And Isis is the feminine goddess, and Osiris is the male god, the powerful male god. But a third figure enters in who's a kind of chaos, Typhon. And chaos cannot kill Osiris, the male god, but he can tear him apart, and he can hide the pieces in different parts of the world. And the task of Isis is to put the pieces back together again so that Osiris can come back to life. And in some ways, what we've done here, I think, is just that magic. Is that we take the hidden pieces. Nora's been hidden away in her laboratory, and I've been hidden away at Amherst, and you're hidden away way over here in Dharamsala, and we've had to find each other, befriend each other, live through each other, and then it comes to life, and there's an energy and power and force which no single one of us could manage. So in this archetype, as you described it, of a contemplative and collaborative community, which this can become ever more, I think that legend lives in me. The other theme which keeps coming back is, as you've identified, this theme of education. An education that takes us from being idiots when we're born, so to speak, filled with the possibilities of the mature life, but it's still all potential. So we come with perfect simplicity into the world, complete dependency. And then we journey from that moment through our lives And we're taught by well-meaning and well-intended teachers and parents and community. But life presents us with challenges, challenges which sometimes demand more of us than what our education, our conventional education, provides. And I think often the deepest education is the education that comes through compassion, which may even cause us to do something which has been against the rules. I think of the life of the Buddha. He sees suffering. He wasn't supposed to go outside the gates, but he did. He sees suffering and he leaves his family. He wasn't supposed to leave his family. So he didn't practice the virtues, you could say. Something more called him, the suffering of all of humanity. And he recognized a task. Your friends, Nelson Mandela, Vaclav Havel, each one of them, you could say, broke the rules. They broke it. They broke those rules because of love, because of compassion. I'm going to give a small gift, which is a book I was just reading, which is a 13th century version of the secular ethics curriculum. It's called Parsifal. Parsifal is protected by his mother, kept from harm, also kept naive like a child, even though he was a young man. He sees two or three knights riding through the forest and he wants to become like they, brave, strong. And so he is educated in the ways of knight-errantry, of being a knight, being noble, being virtuous, being polite and courteous. But then he meets a king who is suffering gravely, and he fails to ask the question which is in his heart, which is, what ails you? How can I help you? Because it was impolite. It wasn't proper. And the rest of the story is the story of his maturation, his development as a human being, so that once again he makes his way back gradually, so that the voice of compassion could heal the wounded Fisher King. So I'm going to offer this to you, Your Holiness, as a token and promise that we'll give an updated version of this to you, the 21st century version of the secular ethics curriculum, as a journey which we hope many, many, many millions of young people will move in their lives from simplicity to love along this great path and not be diverted into grasping and addiction, but find their way to that luminous, light-filled crack and doorway. So thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your leadership and generosity, your humor and presence. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I think I want to share a few words, two or a few words. We human beings, as other sort of mammals, we have this body and mind. Body is because of the, we can see, we can touch. But there is also is experience, consciousness of mind. So I think both level, the pleasure, satisfaction, joyful, pains, both level. So I think as far as body is concerned, physically is concerned, I think with the help of scientific research, our modern science really now brings a lot of sort of comfort. Also the illness, through scientific sort of research, medicines, really very helpful. Then medicine, in order to reduce or in order to eliminate illness. Firstly, body itself. This is some sort of element.
It needs to
be. The
very fact that medicine responds to, the body responds to the medical treatment is there is something inherent in the body that has this ability to be receptive and also kind of gather its kind of resources to be able to, you know, heal itself.
So like a body, mental level also, you see, there are different emotions which really brings the sadness or sorrow.
Suffering.
Suffering, mental suffering. Also, within the mind or emotion, there
are factors that will oppose this, counter them.
So like a physical level, external medicine help. The body's nature sort of forces which kasuta bring healthy. Oh. So similarly, education. I think a proper education, I think immense help. You see, to kasuta
to strengthen the natural resources that we have within our mind internally.
So now I think up to recent years, see, we only pay attention about physical level. So now, I think obviously it's a lot of sort of problem. Ultimately, you see, due to because of the mental difficulties, right? So now, you see, it is quite clear. So the time come, we must explore. Now every way. You see, to kasoda, samne naliya sim mitiwe nyambu chadi ta kala shukya chik.
So find ways in which to really understand how within the mind's own resources there might be factors that we can, you know, cultivate, reinforce that could help deal with the problems that are rooted in the mind itself.
Now here. I think from Buddhist viewpoint, like Buddha mind or Buddhist higher stage of Buddha, because Buddhisattva's mind is the real sort of that kind of medicine for that. That is to us out of question.
Out of reach.
Too far.
Out of reach.
So now we, initial kind of level, yes, we all have this sort of ability. You see, to combat these destructive emotion. So now people, we have that potential, but out of ignorance, you see, we neglect these things. So now our education, give them, there is a possibility within your own emotion, your own mind, can challenge these disturbed emotions. That, I think, the real purpose of our secular education. Not talking about next life. Not talking about God or hell. Not talking. Buddhist, not talking about the nirvana or salvation. These things on even next life. That's private business. When we talk humanity, within this lifetime, there's a lot of disturbances due to mental causes.
The role of the mind.
The role of mind. I think that I want to share. Potential
So, for example, if the potential is not there, if there is no inner resources there, then you know the efforts are pretty, you know, fruitless, futile. Mm. Yeah.
Potential there. You can see among the 7 billion human beings, same human being, same brain, same emotion. Some are much happier, like this morning I mentioned, you see, that monk. Mm-hmm. Same human being, same brain. But out of his sort of certain sort of way of thinking, immense sort of benefit when he passing through difficult period, you see, he can maintain peace of mind. So result, physical also, much healthier. So these are living examples. So why not with other people, without touching Buddhism, without touching, talking about next this life,
religion, no.
But this very life, you see, can be more calm person, more sort of happier person, particularly when passing through difficult period. It's a more challenge, so sort of more enthusiasm, more excited, instead of sort of demoralized, isn't it? So that, I think now, so many years, we discuss these things. So each sort of
each
meeting, it become clearer, clearer, clearer. Oh, 즉 강해 먹고 즉 삼류 돌투해지.
So what is becoming clear every time as we meet is that many of the problems, the source of many of the problems, really lie within the mind.
So 当然是早过读书，多去读书去。
So what we are doing seems to be really touching now upon the root itself.
So all the participants? Right.
All participants.
Thank you. All.
Thank you.
Anyone? You say, I think those people who first time come here, do you find some disturbances about your sleep because of the height? No problem.
I was born in Mexico City, which is very hot.
Oh, right, that's right. Even higher, a little higher. You see, I always carry one of the meter. So this altimeter.
Altimeter. Oh,
this time I found Mexico City, then another sort of place, higher than Dharamsala. Here, about 1,600
meters.
There, about 2,000 meters. One place, even higher. But Ladakh, sometimes you see 4,000 meters. 5,000 meters.
God, I feel it.
Did you ever catch it?
So, what happens to the brain at that time?
The brain depends. The brain can be actually affected because of the pressure, and you can it can swell. So.
등골살에.
등골살 아무 때 어쩌죠
토벌. 내가 싫어 그러지 않습니다. 겁이 있습니다.
나는 때들이.
그러시는 거예요.
So how can it expand? Because there is a kind of it's enclosed skull. Under the skull.
The liquid from the vessel dissipates, so that's why it's dangerous. The skull does not have much space to go, so it pushes. But the mind does not.
The mind does not get any bigger. Does not.
What is it?
So yeah. The brain and the mind are not the same anymore.
Right. This
all
is
right. We figured it out finally.
Oh, this is because bring some curiosity. Ngazul level to sagash to ga. Ko level mar ke kablil ya. Ko to to sagash ga mar la.
So this sort of raises a curious question for His Holiness, because if you look at the structure of the skull, there seem to be some kind of lines. Doesn't that indicate that it allows to be a little flexible, open up?
When you're a baby, when you're a baby, that's not fully formed, and as you grow up, that turns into bone. So that allows the brain to grow.
Oh, that's right. The skull also is enlarged. Right? No. My point is here.
That's why it grows so well.
So in adulthood, the lines of the two sides of the brain when you have kind of
I think
here.
three line one something like that, isn't it?
So is it ever possible that they can expand, open up a little bit in adulthood?
Reason why you see nature create that? I think like
the ribs,
because of the movement. So you see, it creates that way. So skull also, you see, because of some sort
expansion.
Of the expansion, some kind of movement. So you see, nature creates that way.
The belief of why nature created that line is for, first of all, the baby when it's born and it has to come through a passage that's very constrained, it allows it to come closer and pass. And the baby brain is very large, but it's going to grow further. So during a period of 5-6 years, it's still possible for that part is not calcified. But then it becomes calcified, and the moment that those structures, sutures are calcified, it cannot grow anymore. So now as adults, this is calcified, it's bone. It cannot open up anymore. And so if the brain swells, there's no space where it can grow.
That's right.
간다 겐바 차차서나 데데 카체요 말스
맨자 안 근데 좀도 소감도
근데 좀도 부구감 야 달래버도 제고도 가라
티거를 거르셔 주고로
에 드림도 메게 탄다 부구ken 게운도 가라 다 삼아 투미요
근데 감베 로고 이디 쳐셔 주고로
나래 so why in that case for example like in the case of you know thigh bones the bone itself expands. So why wouldn't the brain comes kind of fixed and then the bone structure, the skull, expands?
The bone can so become wider.
The holes of the skull, just one sort of piece. Okay. Skull itself, you see, expand. So why not? You see this one.
So what?
Because it was for your brain to expand when you were a baby and a child and then as an adult.
There's no
Maybe this should be the topic of our next.